Explore the night skies with our large range of high-quality telescopes. Whether you're a novice or an astronomy expert, we have the right telescope for you in our Australian Geographic e-store. Explore the whole range and find the right telescope for you today. Go to australiangeographic.com.au/shop. That's australiangeographic.com.au/shop. Hello, I'm Chrissy Goldrick, and this is Talking Australia, a podcast by Australian Geographic. Today I'm talking to Terry Irwin. Terry is the director of Australia Zoo, one of Australia's premier tourist attractions. She's also a TV personality, perhaps best known for the globally successful Crocodile Hunter series that she made with her late husband Steve Irwin. Terry will be talking about how she built up Australia Zoo, and she'll also share her hopes and dreams for the future, both for herself and her two children, Bindi and Robert. Welcome to Talking Australia and to the second part of our interview with Terry Irwin, recorded at the world-famous Australia Zoo. And it wasn't just Australian wildlife. You filmed all over the world for that series as well. So you sort of highlighted, I suppose you brought the whole world into it. It wasn't really just about our own backyard here.
No, and it was so special because initially it was. So, you know, with budget constraints and so forth, there was a lot of across Australia. And I felt so blessed because coming from America, I have seen more of Australia than most Australians. I have been so fortunate to have driven the length of the Dingo Fence and camped on the Nullarbor Plains and seen the Kimberleys and relocated crocodiles in North Queensland and sat on the beautiful sand dunes of the Simpson Desert. And it's just, this lifestyle was such a blessing, being able to bring all of Australia to people and then to expand from there. So I know Steve was then showcasing wildlife in Africa and the Americas, and being able to travel with him and tell these stories were wonderful. And I've learned so much. I found out that he was very knowledgeable. Steve knew so much about so many things. He didn't even realize it going to Africa, that he had this affinity with wildlife wherever he went. Mm. And for me to be able to keep learning, the formula kept working because I was the, oh my gosh, what do I do here person? And he was so good at being patient and sharing the wildlife that he loved.
And now you got around the world doing that. And then at some stage you decided it was time to have children. So tell us a little bit about how that came about, because that was something I've heard you talk about. It was a sort of almost an impetuous moment of Steve's where he just decided that, wow, we need to have children. We need to have them right now. So tell us the story of Steve deciding that he needed children.
I think that's what I love about Steve so much, is that while there's no word in the English language for the opposite of a procrastinator, that was Steve. And his desire to do everything immediately could be just as challenging as the procrastinator. You know, that do it now attitude. It's like, can we even take a breath? And so that was kind of part of his formula for success, is he didn't put anything off until tomorrow. And it was so special. But I know when we married, as a lot of couples do, you talk about whether or not you're going to have children. And if so, do you have 2 or 10 and all those conversations. And he wasn't terribly passionate about children because he was such an extreme lifestyle person. And it was true. We filmed together from the beginning in some of the most remote areas where you're bathing in dams and sheep's troughs and not really conducive to packing along little people. And then one day he had been out the back fire staring after work, and I was getting some of my last minute work done. And I learned over time that men really do like to fire stare. Mm. We all do.
We do, yeah. It is and maybe poke the fire with a stick every yes. now and again to make sure it's still, I don't know, doing something or whatever.
Yeah, it's very hypnotic and very soothing to watch a fire.
Yeah.
But even modern men fire stare in different ways. Like they might sit down and watch the footy, or they might go surfing, or it's just a moment where they're completely disconnected and doing something that's almost kind of hypnotic, the way you're just relaxing with the waves or TV or, in Steve's case, literally a fire. He'd go in the backyard and build a fire.
Yeah.
So he came in one night in a mad rush, as per usual, and said, "We have to have children." And I said, "Okay, why do we have to have children? Like, what, you know, 6 o'clock in the evening, why at this precise moment?" And he said, "I just thought, who are we going to leave all this to? We have to have kids to carry on where we leave off." And I said, "You know, there's no guarantee that kids are going to love what you love or want to do what you do. You just kind of have to let them be their own people." And Steve said, no. "We'll have kids. They'll love wildlife. They'll want to take over Australia Zoo and do everything we're doing." So I thought, okay, well, I'm keen to have kids. And so our journey began to have little Bindi. And the other thing that we said, which every parent says, which is extremely laughable, is that our lives won't change. No. We're going to have this little new person in our lives and carry on doing everything we've done before. And so we had that conversation as well, leading into having Bindi.
And you had Bindi and you had Robert, and they both more or less born and brought up in a zoo. Now, that's kind of probably a lot of children's dream kind of existence. So tell us a little bit about bringing children up in a zoo and in all of the other environments. I mean, it's like it's an enormous zoo now. It's like it's a big area, but you actually do live here in the zoo, don't you, even today?
Oh, it's really nice. And I think, yes, for kids, it's a great atmosphere and what a fantastic backyard. But we're also a filming family. So Steve was away filming on the Gold Coast and my water broke and I went to the hospital. So he just brought the film crew with him. So Bindi's birth was filmed and in a documentary, as was Robert's. And we still work with Trevor Smith, the cinematographer, today. And shockingly, after filming the whole thing, it's edited down to something quite tidy and heartwarming and beautiful. After filming all of that, Trevor still went on to marry and have his own children. I thought, if we showcase every moment of this birth journey, there'll be a huge crash of population. But no, it was very beautiful and special. And it was a matter of being able to take our kids with us for filming, involve them in what we do with wildlife. And they really did grow up with wildlife in every aspect. So Bindi was 6 days old when she came with us filming, 10 days on her first international film trip. And Robert the same. You know, he was in a plane by the time he was a month old. And we took them everywhere with us. And, you know, everyone has something in common, which is that we either have kids or we've been a kid. So that delight people had in us sharing our journey and our documentary work with children was unexpectedly special. So wherever we filmed, people were very inviting. And yes, the zoo was growing. So it went from 4 acres. I remember when I sold my business and Steve said, she's a beautiful sort. Is that what Australians say?
Yeah.
She's a beautiful sort and she's loaded too. So I sold my business and we bought more acreage and expanded the zoo. And then as Bindi and Robert grew, our lifestyle at Australia Zoo grew with us. And we essentially moved into the Irwin family home. Steve's parents both retired and moved away. So Steve never left home. We just moved in. And his parents moved up to 1770 and retired. And it was nice that we could do that for them. So we made sure they would have a lifetime wage so they could afford to retire and we would continue running the zoo. And now it's almost 1,000 acres, of which just over 100 are open to the public. And it enables us that behind-the-scenes acreage that many city-locked zoos can't do. So, for example, in Sydney, you go to Taronga Zoo, and they do a beautiful job, and it's incredible real estate with a spectacular view. But you're kind of locked in the city. So we're so lucky that the rhinos have 30 acres off display. And when we had elephants, they would roam on 400 acres and tear trees down and eat vegetation. And it was really the biggest sanctuary you could have for these animals. So the behind the scenes is infinitely bigger than what people can experience when they come in and see as our visitors. But for kids, can you imagine? So being able to run around in the beautiful eucalyptus trees and the orchards, because most of everything we bought up were working orchards. So we didn't have to deck any native vegetation. And a lot of it we've integrated in. So when you walk through our koala area, they're all sitting in macadamia trees with little pots that have eucalyptus leaf in them. Because rather than cut the trees down, we just integrated in with it. And so for Bindi and Robert, it was building forts and cubbies and playing hide and seek. And I remember when Bindi was little and she had a pony, because we walk our tigers and cheetahs, she would carry a radio and say, "Tigers copy tigers. Are you walking the tigers? Because I'm going to ride my pony in this area." She'd make sure, because of course the pony would be quite the treat for a tiger. So it was an unusual life growing up, making sure the tigers weren't going for a walk, and yet so beautiful and special.
Sounds idyllic, and I guess also the children were coming away with you on those filming assignments, and they were going to some of your sort of more sort of rural properties and getting out. What an amazing childhood. But of course, it all changed on that terrible day back in 2006 when you received the news that Steve had been killed while out filming on the Great Barrier Reef. You know, a grinding halt, really. And suddenly you were pushed out into the limelight yourself. You had to take over, and you had to be the sort of the go-to person for all of the life that you'd built together. A very, very hard time, and you know, everybody's hearts went out to you and to the children, and you know, there were so many plaudits for Steve. I think we don't realize till someone's gone just how much loved they are. But tell me about that for you personally, having to then step out of his shadow, as it were. Not that you were really in his shadow, but suddenly you had to become that person. You could have run away from it all. You could have gone back to America with the kids, but you haven't done that. And Australia Zoo is bigger than ever, and you're involved. You've got wildlife warriors. You're involved in more things than ever before. So tell me that about that journey. It must have been so hard for you.
I think that's sadly what we all have in common. You know, if you love someone, you're going to experience loss. There's just no way around it. And I think that for us, Steve lived his life as if every day could have been his last. And it wasn't a sad way to live. It was quite inspiring and uplifting. And it's something we all say, but very few of us do. You know, we always put things off for the weekend or for when the kids are grown or we retire. And I thought Steve's ability to embrace life every day was an incredible lesson. And I didn't plan on being a spokesperson for dealing with grief. It sort of became that. But I think it's an important message for everyone, because we will all experience it. And I know when Steve had his accident, I think, first of all, you kind of retreat into your own little bubble, and then you start kind of sorting things out. So first and foremost were Bindi and Robert. I wanted to make sure they were okay and that I was doing right by them and supporting them. And then you start thinking of, you know, the 438 staff that work here, more than 100 volunteers, the people who are like family here, and what's going to happen. And in July of that same year, Steve and I had put together our 10-year business plan. And we couldn't know that less than 2 months later, you know, we'd lose him. But that was an unexpected blessing, to not have to think about what am I going to do from the perspective of the zoo and our conservation work, because it was kind of formatted. And early on the piece, I remember Steve saying to me, "If anything ever happens to me, I hope you'll continue with this." But at that time, you know, we had 10 staff and it was a tiny place. So yes, it was daunting. And I knew more than anything, he wanted to make sure his message continued. He didn't care if he was remembered, although he was so recognized around the world and so acknowledged. And it was incredibly beautiful and moving. But I was floored. We were all floored. Steve would have been surprised at the outpouring of love and compassion from around the world. I think it was about 3 weeks after he died that Bindi came to me and she said, when are we going to start filming again? And that's when I knew it was okay. And I was very lucky because I have a very dear friend who's a psychologist. So he was one of my first phone calls. And I said, Ian, tell me what I can do for my kids. And he said, kids are seeking for this normal. So if you always went, if dad, say, always went surfing with the kids or fishing or hiking and dad's gone, the kids are looking for that again. That's their normal. Can we go for a hike? Because that's what we do. So for Bindi, it was filming. So we were filming Bindi the Jungle Girls series for the ABC. And I said, I think we need to go back to work now. So it was about 3 weeks, and we started up filming again. And the staff had said to me, you know, what do we do in regards to Steve? How do we handle acknowledging Steve? Because Steve was the face of the zoo. And I said, carry on as if he were still here. So just don't worry about it. So I think some people were a little bit uncomfortable because, you know, I think with grief, sometimes you bundle everything up and put it away and go, oh, I don't want to think about this anymore. But with Steve, it was really important just to kind of let him still be a presence. And so now when you come to the zoo, he's everywhere. He's on signs and he's on videos. And people will come in and say, you know, it's really kind of comforting that he in some capacity is still around. And I think so.
And I think that is true. I think with grief, it's other people don't really want to engage you on your loss because they think that you don't want to talk about it. But actually talking about your loved one who's moved on, who's gone out of your life is actually part of finding a place for it and moving on. And I think it's great that, you know, you do come here, and I feel that Steve is really everywhere. There's a big photograph of him jumping up in the air as you come off Steve Irwin Way. And of course you have all the films and the documentary series with him in it. But is that something that you watch? Is that something that you put those films and be all right doing that now? And
yeah, and I think it's so important for people to understand that it's your personal grief journey. And if it's not hurting you and it's not hurting anyone else, then it's okay. So if you keep someone's room the way it was, or you have to put away photos or you have to put out photos, that's not hurting you and it's not hurting anyone else. Probably a bottle of tequila is not the way to go. No. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And what's interesting about grief that I was able to teach people is that sometimes people rise up and they are there for you in a way that you never expected, and it's wonderful. And sometimes the people you thought you could count on the most don't just disappear. They actually kind of turn on you.
Or avoid you almost.
Or be mean. It's weird. So I think that I learned a lot that I can kind of now impart to people who are on a grief journey. But my friend Ian, the psychologist, was so amazing because, you know, you're waiting for the six stages. What are the six stages? How am I going to feel in 2 years and 10 years and how is this going to work? And he said, you know, when you love someone that much, it's kind of like losing part of your heart and you never get over it. And while that sounds incredibly cruel and painful, it actually helped. So my goal hasn't been to wake up one morning and go, well, I'm over that, moving on. And while some people find love again, and that's beautiful, I don't think I would have ever married if I hadn't met Steve. So I don't have any compelling interest in dating or seeing someone else. I'm content in my own shoes and with the person in the mirror, and I have two beautiful kids. And how special for me, because beyond the 300 hours of the shows that we filmed, I have another 8,000 hours of footage that didn't make it through edit. So that for Bindi and Robert, anytime they want to relive a special memory, you just push play. And I remember with Robert, because he was two when Steve died, and you're rather dubious of what he can remember. But when we would watch a documentary when he was really little, we'd watch something and he'd go, I remember such and such, and it's not in the footage, but we did that. So it's fascinating to me how footage and photographs trigger memories in little people that they wouldn't ordinarily have brought to the surface. And it's been extraordinarily helpful for Robert, who's taken a lot longer and has had a harder journey than even Bindi or myself, getting to a point where he's coping with losing his dad, which is fascinating to me for someone so young. But I think that honoring his grief journey and what he needs and just being there to support him has been really important. And he's so much like his dad. It's bizarre.
We'll take a quick break and be back in a moment. We have a special offer for all our listeners. Subscribe to our AG magazine for 6 months for just $30 and save 33% on the newsstand price. That's 3 issues of our award-winning magazine delivered to your home for just $30. Plus, you'll receive exclusive benefits, including 10% off all our products purchased in our e-store. So don't wait. Go to australiangeographic.com.au/talkingaustralia for our special offer. That's australiangeographic.com.au/talkingaustralia. Look, I have been lucky to spend a bit of time with your children over the last few years. And they are really are a delight to be with when they come across so well. And we're seeing a lot of them on television at the moment. But I've spent a little bit of time with them upon the Steve Irwin Reserve out in the bush. And, you know, they're just so at home when they're in the bush. That's what I really. So taking them out to the bush and taking them into nature, is that part of how you sort of coped with? Because you were really under the spotlight after Steve died in such a big way, and all over the media. Is that one of the places that you kind of retreat to when you need, or is it just something you do anyway because you love it?
Yeah, and it's a bit of both. We're really blessed because being in the public eye is wonderful in some aspects. You get your message out to more people. You're able to achieve more positive change. When I see someone that I haven't seen in 20 years, I don't have to tell them what happened to Steve. They know. But on the flip side, we literally had helicopters over this place for 3 weeks every day. And it was difficult escaping the scrutiny and the desire for a photograph or something. And so, yeah, there are beautiful remote places in Australia where we can just disappear and that we love. So stop and think with our crocodile research work. I get to go camping for a month every year in the most beautiful remote areas in Australia. How blessed am I? And I love having kids that are just as happy in a tent, if not happier, than they are in some spectacular hotel room in downtown New York. You know, the luxury aspect of the times we've been put up someplace nice, it's not as big a deal because we've had the beauty of, you know, not 5-star accommodation, but 5 billion-star accommodation. You know, out camping on the Steve Irwin Wildlife Reserve has been fabulous. And I think it's been very grounding for them and very helpful for them. And I often talk to people, if you just, you know, need to feel better, if we're battling the things that we battle today that we never did with social media and the different pressures of the world, it's escaping. It's getting out and reconnecting with nature that's so important. You know, studies have been shown if you look at a picture of a tree, it lowers your blood pressure and you feel better. So imagine what a real tree does. Imagine sitting in a tree, how good you'd feel. And I think we look at places. We know we have this connection because there's a place that's less than 800 acres with nothing endangered, no flora or fauna that's endangered. If it were developed, it would be worth more than $300 billion, and it'll never be developed because it's Central Park in New York. And everyone knows you need this green space, even if there's just squirrels and raccoons and nothing much amazing, you need to reconnect. And I think that's what Bindi and Robert have learned and have been able to teach other young people, how to connect with nature without harming it and how to escape our device-ridden society.
Well, and the really great thing is to see them both developing their own individual brand, really, as it were, and their own individual personality, and they found finding their own way in the world. And, you know, we're really thrilled about Robert's photography, of course, at Australian Geographic. And I think it will be the third year running that he's been shortlisted for the Australian Geographic Nature Photographer of the Year. But as you say, he is so like his dad. Is that likely to, is that a good, always a good thing for him, or is it something that he feels he has to live up to? How does he go with all the comparisons he must get with the young Steve Irwin?
And I think it's a really good thing, and I think it's natural because his mannerisms and his passions are so much like Steve's. You know, Steve was an avid photographer who shot with film because there were no digital cameras. They were just emerging some 12 years ago. And so they share a lot of the same passions and hobbies and so forth. And I also think it's important that we all understand that what happened to Steve was a tragic accident. So in other words, you know, Bindi still swims with whale sharks and Robert still surfs. And I encourage being in our beautiful oceans and experiencing that wildlife. And that poor little sea pancake didn't mean to hurt Steve, you know? It was something that hadn't happened for 75 years in this country. So it's not really something that's top of the list of worrying about things. And I find they can be such leaders in that field. So for Bindi, being able to kind of mainstream conservation has been her passion. So if she can take the message of conservation to the audience that watches Dancing with the Stars in America, that's such an achievement. And Robert, with his photography, has found something that I've been able to support him in his journey of finding out what kind of that, why am I here? What am I good at? What are my passions? And what would I like to do? And for him, you know, being a part of the Australian Geographic photography competition is something he wants to really encourage young people, especially girls, because for some reason, and I don't know why, there are more boys and men involved in photography than girls and women. And it's something that's very friendly to all of us. It's easy to pick up a camera, and it's easy to have a unique perspective on things. And that's what's so amazing about photography. I can look at a situation and go, that is really beautiful. And then Robert will photograph it and show me the photo, and I'll go, oh, it's so much more breathtaking than when I'm just looking at it. So I'll challenge him. And one time my passports were stolen in Spain, and we ended up in Madrid getting new passports. And we're doing laundry in this old antiquated laundromat. And I looked at the dryer that's clunking along, and I go, make that pretty. And he took a photograph of it, and it just looks like the most beautiful, antique, special thing. That's what photography can do. And bringing the story to people about wildlife conservation in a way that you don't need words, whether Bindi did with dance, Robert does with photography, that's very unique. And I would encourage people to get that connection. And we all think, oh yeah, some people work on wildlife. I recycle, that's good. And it is good. Everyone needs to do something. But how are you connecting? Because it's so important. We all connect with things that we may not be good at. I like eating. I'm a lousy cook. I love music. I can't sing. I appreciate art. I draw stick figures. And when it comes to conservation, if Bindi and Robert can encourage young people not just to appreciate someone else doing it, but getting involved, we'll really achieve something.
Well, two very impressive young people to be very proud of, and such natural,
thank you,
gifted communicators. And I, you know, they've really, I think you've done such a great job with all of the pressures that are on you. And I know that occasionally you cop some flack about the children, and I think you've sort of ridden through it with great dignity and with great grace. And I do know that the bush is one of those places that is very, it's just good for the soul, isn't it? Getting out and getting under the stars. And I think, you know, the Steve Irwin Reserve was set aside by the John Howard government after Steve died. I think they wanted to name a national park in his honour, but you decided to take on a conservation reserve and run it yourselves. and is a very special place. And that's really where I first met you, and it's where I've met Bindi and Robert. And it's the site of the world's longest running crocodile research project. Isn't that right?
Yes, and now it's the longest running behavioral study continuously running of any animal. So it's been a point of pride to be able to fund research, preferably in perpetuity. So many researchers run out of money in 5, 10, 20 years. So what we're doing through University of Queensland and Australia Zoo is ensuring generational research. So when I'm dead and gone, Bindi and Robert will pick up the mantle and continue with the research work that's so important. And we do support a myriad of research, but the crocodilian research is most important. And the reason why is because our apex predators are the most critically important component of any ecosystem. So the trophic cascade effect of predators can probably be best described with the wolves in Yellowstone National Park. And the wolves were completely extirpated. They were taken out of Yellowstone, so there were no more wolves in the park. And you would think that would be so good for the prey animals and that they would just flourish. But what happened was it just changed the dynamics of the ecosystem. With the reintroduction of the wolf, all of a sudden, not only were elk and deer and buffalo getting preyed upon by the wolves, they were scared of the wolves. So suddenly all these animals said, "Don't go into the valley, there's wolves." And as they stayed clear of the open areas, trees and bushes and sedges and everything regenerated. The actual flow of rivers changed. The beaver came back and built dams. And the entire ecosystem is now flourishing just by the reintroduction of wolves. Mm. And with the crocodiles, it's difficult for me to demonstrate that because you can't remove the crocodiles completely from any area. They travel 60 kilometers in a day. Mm. They can travel 1,000 kilometers in a single journey. And quite literally, you could have them coming and going from East Timor or Indonesia. So you can't really...
Can it be the same crocodile swimming all that way?
Potentially.
From Cape York?
Potentially. Mm. And again, our study crocs haven't indicated anything more than 1,000, 1,500 kilometer movements, but potentially. And Cape York, the tip of Cape York, is closer to Papua New Guinea than Cairns. So potentially. And I look at them and I understand that we need to protect them. And scientifically, we can demonstrate that we need to protect them. But it's difficult to be as poignant as, for example, in Oregon, there was a study where they took all the starfish out of tide pools, just a couple tide pools. And again, the starfish were the apex predator. The tide pools died. Nothing in them flourished. And you would have thought they would have because you took the predator out. They all died. Mm. So how fascinating to me that we can now demonstrate scientifically how important the crocodiles are. So what have we learned? Oh my goodness, you can't relocate a crocodile. We moved one from the west side of the Cape to the east side of the Cape, blindfolded in a helicopter. And from August to December, it found its way home by moving with the currents up one side around the tip and down the other side of Cape York to within 100 meters of where we'd caught it. So that's out the window. We've learned they can hold their breath for more than 7 hours, longer than any air-breathing animal. So now we're rewriting biology books. And how important for you and me to know, if you're camped by the river and you haven't seen a crocodile all day, it could still be right in front of you, just under the water. So don't swim. Mm. So what a great educational point. And then other things we've never known, through isotope studies, we've learned that not all big crocodiles eat big food items. And this is the secret to their success. Sure, little crocodiles eat insects and frogs and tiny things because they're not going to be after big things. But we've studied some crocodiles that are fish specialists. So they sit at a crossing. Tide comes in, open your mouth. Tide goes out, move to the other side of the crossing, open your mouth. It's astonishing, but that's probably why they've survived 200 million years. They're not all out there hunting one thing, and there's nothing you can die of less, maybe rays, but there's nothing you can statistically die of less really in Australia than croc strike. Less than one person a year. Mm. More people die choking on lollies than from crocodiles. So really they're not hunting people. Really, you have to make a mistake and enter the water.
Enter their territory.
Yes. So, wow, what we've learned and how exciting. So for Bindi, it's particularly exciting because her passion is science. And again, 30% of our scientists are women. So she's a great role model. But now here's our modern challenge, not just getting women interested in science, but getting people to listen to the science. So now, whether it's politicians or people in positions of power, now that's the biggest challenge.
Yeah. So Bindi is going to, this is her area of interest, and she's in a really good position to sort of, she's a good role model for young women.
And she's been studying crocodiles with UQ literally since she was 7 years old.
I've seen her with all of the, you know, holding all of the equipment and handing it over to Professor Craig Franklin as he takes the blood from the crocodile and just staying as calm and just like, watching everything and sort of taking it on. Look, I think she'll be a great advocate for crocodile research and crocodile protection, and Robert too. And I think they're just two children to be very proud of. And it's been great speaking to you
this morning,
Terry, here in the zoo.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. That's it for today's episode of Talking Australia. If you have questions or comments, feel free to reach out. Write us an email. podcast@australiangeographic.com. Or find us on Instagram @Australian Geographic. And if you go to australiangeographic.com.au/talkingaustralia, you'll find special offers for our listeners, including 10% off all products purchased in our e-store. So don't wait and go to australiangeographic.com.au/talkingaustralia. Also, make sure to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts from, so you never miss an episode. Thanks for listening. Until next time.